gazed at him, and he knew he had failed their trust in him, and he would plead, saying, "If I had not run away, the shadow would have possessed me. It had already all Skjalf's strength and part of mine, and I could not fight it. It knew my name. It knew my name. I had to run away. A wizard Geveth would be a terrible power for evil and ruin. I had to run away." But none of those who listened in his mind would answer him, and he would watch the snow falling thin and ceaseless on the empty lands below the window, and feel the dull cold grow within him till it seemed no feeling was left to him except a kind of weariness. So he kept to himself for many days out of sheer misery, and when he did come down out of his room, he was silent and stiff, and the beauty of the Lady of the Keep confused his mind, and in this rich, seemly, orderly, strange court, he felt himself to be a goatherd, born and bred. They let him alone when he wanted to be alone, and when he could not stand to think his thoughts and watch the falling snow any longer, often Serret met with him in one of the curving halls, tapestried and firelit, lower in the tower, and there they would talk. There was no merriment in the Lady of the Keep. She never laughed, though she often smiled. Yet she could put Ged at ease almost with one smile. With her he began to forget his stiffness and his shame. Before long they met every day to talk, long, quietly, idly, a little apart from the serving women who always accompanied Serret, by the fireplace or at the window of the high rooms of the tower. The old lord kept mostly in his own apartments, coming forth mornings to pace up and down the snowy inner courtyards of the castle keep, like an old sorcerer who has been brewing spells all night. And when he joined Ged and Serret for supper, he sat silent, looking up at his young wife sometimes with a hard, covetous glance. And then Ged pitied her. She was like a white deer caged, like a white bird wing-clipped, like a silver ring on an old man's finger. She was an item of Benderesk's hoard. When the Lord of the Keep left them, Ged stayed with her, trying to cheer her solitude as she had cheered his. What is this jewel that gives your keep its name? He asked her as they sat talking over their emptied gold plates and gold goblets in the cavernous, candle-lit dining hall. You have not heard of it. It is a famous thing. No, I know only that the lords of Oskil have famous treasuries. This jewel outshines them all. Come, would you like to see it? She smiled, with a look of mockery and daring, as if a little afraid of what she did. And she led the young man from the hall, out through the narrow corridors of the base of the tower, and downstairs underground to a locked door he had not seen before. This she unlocked with a silver key, looking up at Ged with that same smile as she did so, as if she dared him to come on with her. Beyond the door was a short passage, and a second door, which she unlocked with a gold key, and beyond that again a third door, which she unlocked with one of the great words of unbinding. Within that last door her candle showed them a small room like a dungeon cell, floor, walls, ceiling all rough stone, unfurnished, blank. Do you see it? As Ged looked round the room, his wizard's eye caught one stone of those that made the floor. It was rough and dank as the rest, a heavy, unshapen paving stone, yet he felt the power of it as if it spoke to him aloud, and his breath caught in his throat and a sickness came over him for a moment. This was the founding stone of the tower, this was the central place, and it was cold, bitter cold. Nothing could ever warm the little room. This was a very ancient thing. An old and terrible spirit was prisoned in that block of stone. He did not answer Serret yes or no, but stood still, and presently, with a quick, curious glance at him, she pointed out the stone. That is the Terranon. Do you wonder that we keep so precious a jewel locked away in our deepest hoard room? Still Ged did not answer, but stood dumb and wary. She might almost have been testing him, but he thought she had no notion of the stone's nature to speak of it so lightly. She did not know enough of it to fear it. "Tell me of its powers," he said at last.
It was made before Sigoy raised the islands of the world from the open sea. It was made when the world itself was made, and will endure until the end of the world."
Time is nothing to it. If you lay your hand upon it and ask a question of it, it will answer according to the power that is in you. It has a voice, if you know how to listen. It will speak of things that were and are and will be. It told of your coming long before you came to this land. Will you ask a question of it now?
No. It will answer you. There is no question I would ask it.
Well, it might tell you, Sarit said in her soft voice, how you will defeat your enemy.
Ged stood mute. Do you fear the stone? She asked as if unbelieving, and he answered, yes. In the deadly cold and silence of the room, encircled by wall after wall of spellwork and of stone, in the light of the one candle she held, Sarit glanced at him again with gleaming eyes.
Sparrowhawk, she said, you are not afraid.
But I will not speak with that spirit, Ged replied, and looking full at her, spoke with a grave boldness. My lady, that spirit is sealed in a stone, and the stone is locked by binding spell and blinding spell and charm of lock and ward and triple fortress walls in a barren land, not because it is precious, but because it can work great evil. I do not know what they told you of it when you came here, but you who are young and gentle-hearted should never touch the thing or even look on it. It will not work you well.
I have touched it. I have spoken to it and heard it speak. It does me no harm.
She turned away, and they went out through the doors and passages till in the torchlight of the broad stairs of the tower she blew out her candle. They parted with few words. And that night Ged slept little. It was not the thought of the shadow that kept him awake. Rather, that thought was almost driven from his mind by the image ever returning of the stone on which this tower was founded, and out through the doors and passages, till in the torchlight of the broad stairs of the tower she blew out her candle. They parted with few words. And that night Ged slept little. It was not the thought of the shadow that kept him awake. Rather, that thought was almost driven from his mind by the image ever returning of the stone on which this tower was founded, and by the vision of Sarit's face, bright and shadowy in the candlelight, turned to him, and again he felt her eyes on him and tried to decide what look had come into those eyes when he refused to touch the stone, whether it had been disdain or hurt. When he lay down to sleep at last, the silken sheets of the bed were cold as ice, and ever he wakened in the dark thinking of the stone and of Sarit's eyes. Next day he found her in the curving hall of gray marble, lit now by the westering sun, where often she spent the afternoon at games or at the weaving loom with her maids, and he said to her, Lady Sarit, I affronted you. I am sorry for it.
No, she said musingly, and again, no, no, no.
She sent away the serving women who were with her, and when they were alone she turned to Ged.
My guest, my friend, you are very clear-sighted, but perhaps you do not see all that is to be seen. In Gaunt, in Roke, they teach high wizardries, but they do not teach all wizardries. This is Oskill, Ravenland. It is not Hardik land. Mages do not rule it, nor do they know much of it. There are happenings here not dealt with by the lore masters of the South, and things here not named in the namers' lists. What one does not know, one fears. But you have nothing to fear here in the court of the Terranon. A weaker man would, indeed, but not you. You are one born with the power to control that which is in the sealed room. This I know. It is why you are here now.
I do not understand.
That is because my Lord Benderesk has not been wholly frank with you. I will be frank. Come, sit by me here.
He sat down beside her on the deep cushioned window ledge. The dying sunlight came level through the window, flooding them with a radiance in which there was no warmth, and the moorlands below, already sinking into shadow, like last night's snow, lay unmelted, a dull white pall over the earth. He spoke now very softly.
Benderesk is lord and inheritor of the Terranon, but he cannot use the thing. He cannot make it wholly serve his will, nor can I, alone or with him. Neither he nor I has the skill and power. You have both.
How do you know that?
From the stone itself. I told you that it spoke of your coming. It knows its master. It has waited for you to come. Before ever you were born, it waited for you, for the one who could master it. And he who can make the Pteranon answer what he asks and do what he wills has power over his own destiny. Strength to crush any enemy, mortal or of the other world. Foresight, knowledge, wealth, dominion, and a wizardry at his command that could humble the Archmage himself. As much of that, as little of that as you choose, is yours for the asking. Once more she lifted her strange bright eyes to him, and her gaze pierced him so that he trembled as if with cold. Yet there was fear in her face, as if she sought his help but was too proud to ask it. Ged was bewildered. She had put her hand on his, and she spoke. Its touch was light. It looked narrow and fair on his dark stroke hand, and he said, pleading, "Sarid, I have no such power as you think. What I had once I threw away. I cannot help you. I am no use to you. But I know this. The old powers of Earth are not for Ben to use. They were never given into our hands, and in our hands they work only ruin. Ill means ill end. I was not drawn here, but driven here, and the force that drove me works to my undoing. I cannot help you." "He who throws away his power is filled sometimes with a far greater power." She said this, smiling as if his fears and scruples were childish ones. "I may know more than you of what brought you here. Did not a man speak to you in the streets of Orome? He was a messenger, a servant of the Pteranon. He was a wizard once himself, but he threw away his staff to serve a power greater than any mage's. And you came to Uskill, and on the moors you tried to fight a shadow with your wooden staff, and almost we could not save you, for that thing that follows you is more cunning than we deemed, and had taken much strength from you already. Only shadow can fight shadow. Only darkness can defeat the dark. Listen, Sparrowhawk, what do you need, then, to defeat that shadow which waits for you outside these walls?" "I need what I cannot know. Its name." "The Pteranon that knows all births and deaths and beings before and after death, the unborn and the undying, the bright world and the dark one, will tell you that name."
"Uh-huh. And the price?"
"There is no price. I tell you, it will obey you, serve you as your slave."
Shaken and tormented, he did not answer. She held his hand now in both of hers, looking into his face. The sun had fallen into the mists that dulled the horizon, and the air, too, had grown dull. But her face grew bright with praise and triumph as she watched him and saw his will shaken within him. Softly, she whispered, "You will be mightier than all men. A king among men. You will rule, and I will rule with you." Suddenly Ged stood up, and one step forward took him where he could see, just around the curve of the long room's wall, beside the door, the Lord of the Pteranon, who stood listening and smiling a little. Ged's eyes cleared, and his mind. He looked down at Sarit. "It is light that defeats the dark," he said, stammering. "Light!" As he spoke, he saw, as plainly as if his own words were the light that showed him, how indeed he had been drawn here, lured here, how they had used his fear to lead him on, and how they would, once they had him, have kept him. They had saved him from the shadow, indeed, for they did not want him to be possessed by the shadow until he had become a slave of the stone. And once his will was captured by the power of the stone, then they would let the shadow into the walls, for a Gebeth was a better slave even than a man. If he had once touched the stone or spoken to it, he would have been utterly lost. Yet even as the shadow had not quite been able to catch up with him and seize him, so the stone had not been able to use him. Not quite. He had almost yielded, but not quite. He had not consented. It is very hard for evil to take hold of the unconsenting soul. He stood between the two who had yielded, who had consented, looking from one to the other as Benderesk came forward.
"I told you the Lord of the Terranon said, dry voice to his lady, that he would slip from your hands, Sarit. They are clever fools, your Gauntish sorcerers, and you are a fool too, woman of Gaunt, thinking to trick both him and me, and rule us both by your beauty, and use the Terranon to your own ends. But I am the Lord of the Stone, and this I do to the disloyal wife, Ekavroi I Ulvantar. It was a spell of changing, and Benderesk's long hands were raised to shape the cowering woman into some hideous thing, swine or dog or driveling hag. Ged stepped forward and struck the Lord's hands down with his own, saying as he did so only one short word. And though he had no staff, and stood on alien ground and evil ground, the domain of a dark power, yet his will prevailed. Benderesk stood still, his clouded eyes fixed hateful and unseeing upon Sarit. "Come," she said in a shaking voice, Sparrowhawk aching voice, come, quick, before he can summon the servants of the stone. As if in echo, a whispering ran through the tower, through the stones of the floor and walls, a dry, trembling murmur as if the earth itself should speak. Seizing Ged's hand, Sarit ran with him through the passages and halls, down the long, twisted stairs. They came out into the courtyard where a last silvery daylight still hung above the soil-trodden snow. Three of the castle servants barred their way, sullen and questioning, as if they had been suspecting some plot of these two against their master. "It grows dark, lady," one said, and another, "You cannot ride out now." "Out of my way, filth!" Sarit cried, and spoke in the sibilant Oskillian speech. The men fell back from her and crouched down to the ground, writhing, and one of them screamed aloud. "We must go out by the gate. There is no other way out. Can you see it? Can you find it, Sparrowhawk?" She tugged at his hand, yet he hesitated. "What spell did you set on them?" "I ran hot lead in the marrow of their bones. They will die of it. Quick, I tell you, he will loose the servants of the stone, and I cannot find the gate. There is a great charm on it. Quick!" Ged did not know what she meant, for to him the enchanted gate was as plain to see as the stone archway of the court through which he saw it. He led Sarit through the one, across the untrodden snow of the forecourt, and then, speaking a word of opening, he led her through the gate of the Wall of Spells. She changed as they passed through that doorway out of the silvery twilight of the court of the Terranon. She was not less beautiful in the drear light of the moors, but there was a fierce witch-look to her beauty, and Ged knew her at last, the daughter of the Lord of the Realbi. Daughter of a sorceress of Oskil, who had mocked him in the green meadows above Ogion's house long ago, and had sent him to read that spell which loosed the shadow. But he spent small thought on this, for he was looking about him now with every sense alert, looking for that enemy, the shadow, which would be waiting for him somewhere outside the magic walls. It might be Gebeth still, clothed in Skjorg's death, or it might be hidden in the gathering darkness, waiting to seize him and merge its shapelessness with his living flesh. He sensed its nearness. He did not see it. But as he looked, he saw some small dark thing half buried in snow, a few paces from the gate. He stooped and then softly picked it up in his two hands. It was the Otak, its fine short fur all clogged with blood, and its small body light and stiff and cold in his hands.
"Change yourself! Change yourself! They are coming!" Sarit shrieked, seizing his arm and pointing to the tower that stood behind them like a tall white tooth in the dusk. From slit windows near its base, dark creatures were creeping forth, flapping long wings, slowly beating and circling up over the walls towards Ged and Sarit where they stood on the hillside unprotected. The rattling whisper they had heard inside the keep had grown louder, a tremor and moaning in the earth under their feet. Anger welled up in Ged's heart, a hot rage of hate against all the cruel, deathly things that tricked him, trapped him, hunted him down. "Change yourself!" Sarit screamed at him, and she, with a quick gasped spell, shrank into a gray gull and flew. But Ged stooped and plucked a blade of wild grass that poked up dry and frail out of the snow where the Otak had lain dead. This blade he held up, and as he spoke aloud to it in the true speech, it lengthened and thickened, and when he was done he held a great staff, a wizard's staff, in his hand. No banefire burned red along it when the black flapping creatures from the court of the Terranon swooped over him, and he struck their wings with it. It blazed only with the white mage fire that does not burn but drives away the dark.
The creatures returned to the attack, botched beasts belonging to ages before bird or dragon or man, long since forgotten by the daylight but recalled by the ancient malign, unforgetful power of the stone. They harried Ged, swooping at him. He felt the side-sweep of their talons about him and sickened in their dead stench. Fiercely he parried and struck, fighting them off with the fiery staff that was made of his anger and a blade of wild grass. And suddenly they all rose, up, up like ravens frightened from carrion, and wheeled away, flapping, silent, in the direction that Sarit and her gull shape had flown. Their vast wings seemed slow, but they flew fast, each downbeat driving them mightily through the air. No gull could long outmatch that heavy speed. Quick, as he had once done at Roke, Ged took the shape of a great hawk. Not the sparrowhawk, they called him, but the pilgrim falcon, that flies like arrow, like thought. On barred, sharp, strong wings he flew, pursuing his pursuers. The air darkened, and among the clouds stars shone, brightening. Ahead he saw the black, ragged flock all driving down, and in upon one point in midair. Beyond that black clot the sea lay, pale with last ashy gleam of day. Swift and straight the hawk Ged shot towards the creatures of the stone, and they scattered as he came amongst them as water drops scatter from a cast pebble. But they had caught their prey. Blood was on the beak of this one, and white feathers stuck to the claws of another, and no gull skimmed beyond them over the pallid sea. Already they were turning on Ged again, coming quick and ungainly with iron beaks stretched out agape. He, wheeling once above them, screamed the hawk's scream of defiant rage, and then shot on across the low beaches of Oskil, out over the breakers of the sea. The creatures of the stone circled a while, croaking, and one by one beat back ponderously inland over the moors. The old powers will not cross over the sea, being bound each to an isle, a certain place, cave, or stone or welling spring. Back went the black emanations to the tower keep, where maybe the lord of the Terranon, Benderesk, wept at their return, and maybe laughed. But Ged went on, falcon-winged, falcon-mad, like an unfalling arrow, like an unforgotten thought, over the Oskil Sea, and eastward into the wind of winter and the night. Ogion the Silent had come home late to Rhaalbi from his autumn wanderings, more silent, more solitary than ever he had become as the years went on. The new Lord of Gaunt down in the city below had never got a word out of him, though he had climbed clear up to the falcon's nest to seek the help of the mage in a certain piratic venture towards the Andrades. Ogion, who spoke to spiders on their webs and had been seen to greet trees courteously, never said a word to the Lord of the Isle, who went away discontented. There was perhaps some discontent or unease also in Ogion's mind, for he had spent all summer and autumn alone up on the mountain, and only now, near sun return, was come back to his hearthside. The morning after his return he rose late, and wanting a cup of rushwash tea, he went out to fetch water from the spring that ran a little way down the hillside from his house. The margins of the spring's small, lively pool were frozen, and the sere moss among the rocks was traced with flowers of frost. It was broad daylight, but the sun would not clear the mighty shoulder of the mountain for an hour yet. All western Gaunt, from sea beaches to the peak, was sunless, silent, and clear in the winter morning. As the mage stood by the spring, looking out over the falling lands and the harbor and the gray distances of the sea, wings beat above him, and he looked up, raising one arm a little. A great hawk came down with loud beating wings and light beating wings, hit on his wrist. Like a trained hunting bird it clung there, but it wore no broken leash, no band or bell. The claws dug hard in Ogion's wrist, and the barred wings trembled. The round gold eye was dull and wild. "Are you messenger or message?" Ogion said gently to the hawk. "Come on with me." As he spoke, the hawk looked at him. Ogion was silent a minute. "I named you once, I think," he said, and then strode to his house and entered, bearing the bird still on his wrist. He made the hawk stand on the hearth in the fire's heat and offered it water. It would not drink. Then Ogion began to lay a spell, very quietly, weaving the web of magic with his hands more than with words. And when the spell was whole and woven, he said softly, "Ged," not looking at the falcon on the hearth. He waited some while, and then turned, and got up, and went to the young man, who stood trembling and dull-eyed before the fire. Ged was richly and outlandishly dressed in fur and silk and silver, but the clothes were torn and stiff with sea salt, and he stood, gaunt and stooped, his hair lank about his scarred face. Ogion took the soiled princely cloak off his shoulders, led him to the alcove room where his prentice once had slept, and made him lie down on the pallet there, and so, with a murmured sleep charm, left him. He had said no word to him, knowing that Ged had no human speech in him now. As a boy, Ogion, like all boys, had thought it would be a very pleasant game to take by art magic whatever shape one liked, man or beast, tree or cloud, and so to play at a thousand beings. But as a wizard, he had learned the price of the game, which is the peril of losing oneself playing away the truth. The longer a man stays in a form not his own, the greater this peril. Every prentice sorcerer learns the tale of the wizard Borger of Way, who delighted in taking bear's shape, and did so more and more often until the bear grew in him, and the man died away, and he became a bear, and killed his own little son in the forests, and was hunted down and slain. And no one knows how many of the dolphins that leap in the waters of the inmost sea were men once, wise men who forgot their wisdom and their name in the joy of the restless sea. Ged had taken hawk shape in fierce distress and rage, and when he flew from Oskill there had been but one thought in his mind, to outfly both stone and shadow, to escape the cold, treacherous lands, to go home. The falcon's anger and wildness were like his own, and had become his own, and his will to fly had become the falcon's will. And thus he had passed over Enlad, stooping down to drink at a lonely forest pool, but on the wing again at once, driven by fear of the shadow that came behind him. So he had crossed the great sea lane called the Jaws of Enlad, and gone on and on, east by south, the hills of Aranea faint to his right, and the hills of Andrad fainter to his left, and before him only the sea, until at last ahead there rose up out of the waves one unchanging wave, towering always higher, the white peak of Gaunt. In all the sunlight and the dark of that great flight, he had worn the falcon's wings and looked through the falcon's eyes, and forgetting his own thoughts, he had known at last only what the falcon knows: hunger, the wind, the way he flies. He flew to the right haven. There were few on Roke, and only one on Gaunt who could have made him back into a man. He was savage and silent when he woke. Ogion never spoke to him, but gave him meat and water and let him sit hunched by the fire, grim as a great, weary, sulking hawk. And when night came he slept, and on the third morning he came into the fireside where the mage sat gazing at the flames, and said, "Master."
"Welcome, lad," said Ogion. "I have come back to you as I left, a fool," his voice harsh and thickened.
The mage smiled a little and motioned Ged to sit across the hearth from him, and set to brewing them some tea. Snow was falling, the first of the winter here on the lower slopes of Gaunt. Ogion's windows were shuttered fast, but they could hear the wet snow as it fell soft on the roof, and the deep stillness of snow all about the house. A long time they sat there by the fire, and Ged told his old master the tale of the years since he had sailed from Gaunt aboard the ship called Shadow. Ogion asked no questions, and when Ged was done he kept silent for a long time, calm, pondering. And then he rose and set out bread and cheese and wine on the table, and they ate together. When they had done and had set the room straight, Ogion spoke.
"Those are bitter scars you bear, lad. I have no strength against the thing."
Ogion shook his head, but said no more for a time. At length,
"Strange," he said. "You had strength enough to outspell a sorcerer
in his own domain there in Oskil, you had strength enough to withstand the lures and fend off the attack of the servants of an old power of Earth, and at Pendor, you had strength enough to stand up to a dragon. It was luck I had in Oskil, not strength, Ged replied, and he shivered again as he thought of the dreamlike deathly cold of the court of the Terranon. As for the dragon, I knew his name. The evil thing, the shadow that hunts me, has no name. All things have a name, said Ogion, so certainly that Ged dared not repeat what the Archmage Genscher had told him, that such evil forces as he had loosed were nameless. The Dragon of Pendor, indeed, had offered to tell him the Shadow's name, but he put little trust in the truth of that offer, nor did he believe Sereth's promise that the stone would tell him what he needed to know. If the Shadow has a name, he said at last, I do not think it will stop and tell it to me. No, said Ogion, nor have you stopped and told it your name, and yet it knew it. On the moors in Oskil, it called you by your name, the name I gave you. It is strange, strange. He fell to brooding again. At last Ged said, I came here for counsel, not for refuge, master. I will not bring this shadow upon you, and it will soon be here if I stay, once you drove it from this very room. No, that was but the foreboding of it. The shadow of a shadow, I could not drive it forth now. Only you could do that. But I am powerless before it. Is there any place? His voice died away before he had asked the question.
There is no safe place, Ogion said gently. Do not transform yourself again, Ged. The shadow seeks to destroy your true being. It nearly did so, driving you into Hawksby, into Hawksby, into... No. Where you should go, I do not know. Yet I have an idea of what you should do. It is a hard thing to say to you.
Ged's silence demanded truth, and Ogion said at last,
You must turn around.
Turn around?
If you go ahead... If you keep running, wherever you run, you will meet danger and evil, for it drives you. It chooses the way you go. You must choose. You must seek what seeks you. You must hunt the hunter.
Ged said nothing. At the spring of the river Ar, I named you, the mage said. A stream that falls from the mountain to the sea. A man would know the end he goes to, but he cannot know it if he does not turn and return to his beginning, and hold that beginning in his being. If he would not be a stick whirled and whelmed in the stream, he must be the stream itself, all of it, from its spring to its sinking in the sea. You returned to Gaunt. You returned to me, Ged. Now turn clear around, and seek the very source, and that which lies before the source, and there lies your hope of strength.
There, master? Ged said with terror in his voice. Where?
Ogion did not answer.
If I turn, Ged said after some time had gone by, if, as you say, I hunt the hunter, I think the hunt will not be long. All its desire is to meet me face to face, and twice it has done so, and twice defeated me.
Third time is the charm, said Ogion.
Ged paced the room up and down, from fireside to door, from door to fireside.
And if it defeats me wholly, he said, arguing perhaps with Ogion, perhaps with himself, it will take my knowledge and my power and use them. It threatens only me now, but if it enters into me and possesses me, it will work great evil through me.
That is true, if it defeats you.
Yet if I run again, it will as surely find me again, and all my strength is spent in the running.
Ged paced on a while and then suddenly turned, and kneeling before the mage, he said,
I have walked with great wizards and have lived on the Isle of the Wise, but you are my true master, Ogion." He spoke with love and with a somber joy. "Good," said Ogion. "Now you know it. Better now than never. But you will be my master in the end." He got up and built up the fire to a good blaze and hung the kettle over to boil, and then pulling out his sheepskin coat said, "I must go look after my goats. Watch the kettle for me, lad." And when he came back in, all snow-powdered and stomping snow from his goatskin boots, he carried a long, rough shaft of yew wood. All the end of the short afternoon and again after their supper, he sat working by lampfire on the shaft with knife and rubbing stone and spellcraft. Many times he passed his hands along the wood as if seeking any flaw. Often as he worked, he sang softly. Ged, still weary, listened, and as he grew sleepy, he thought himself a child in the witch's hut in Ten Alders Village, on a snowy night in the firelit dark, the air heavy with herb scent and smoke, and his mind all adrift on dreams as he listened to the long, soft singing of spells and deeds of heroes who fought against dark powers and won, or lost, on distant islands long ago. "There," said Ogion, and handed the finished staff to him. "The archmage gave you wood, a good choice, and I kept to it. I meant the shaft for a longbow, but it's better this way. Good night, my son." As Ged, who found no words to thank him, turned away to his alcove room, Ogion watched him and said, too soft for Ged to hear, "Oh, my young falcon, fly well." In the cold dawn, when Ogion woke, Ged was gone. Only he had left in wizardly fashion a message of silver-scrawled runes on the hearthstone that faded even as Ogion read them. "Master, I go hunting." Chapter 8. Hunting. Ged had set off down the road from Rhaelbi in the winter dark before sunrise, and before noon he came to the port of Gaunt. Ogion had given him decent Gauntish leggings and shirt and vest of leather and linen to replace his Oscillian finery, but Ged had kept for his winter journey the lordly cloak lined with Palawi fur. And so cloaked, empty-handed but for the dark staff that matched his height, he came to the land gate, and the soldiers lounging against the carven dragons there did not have to look twice at him to see the wizard. They drew aside their lances and let him enter without question, and watched him as he went on down the street. On the quays and in the house of the Sea Guild, he asked of ships that might be going out north or west to Enlad, Andrad, or Aranea, and all answered him that no ship would be leaving Gauntport now, so near sun return, and at the Sea Guild they told him that even fishing boats were not going out through the armed cliffs in the untrusty weather. They offered him dinner at the buttery there in the Sea Guild. A wizard seldom has to ask for his dinner. He sat a while with those longshoremen, shipwrights, and weather workers, taking pleasure in their slow, sparse conversation, their grumbling, gauntish speech. There was a great wish in him to stay here on Gaunt, and foregoing all wizardry and venture, forgetting all power and horror, to live in peace like any man on the known, dear ground of his homeland, and that was his wish. But his will was other. He didn't stay long in the Sea Guild, nor in the city, after he found there would be no ships out of port. He set out, walking along the bay shore, till he came to the first of the small villages that lie north of the city of Gaunt, and there he asked among the fishermen, till he found one that had a boat to sell. The fisherman was a dour old man. His boat, 12 foot long and clinker-built, was so warped and sprung as to be scarce seaworthy, yet he asked a high price for her. The spell of sea safety for a year laid on his own boat, himself, and his son. For Gauntish fishermen fear nothing, not even wizards, only the sea.
That spell of sea safety which they set much store by in the northern archipelago never saved a man from storm wind or storm wave, but cast by one who knows the local seas and the ways of a boat and the skills of the sailor, it weaves some daily safety about the fisherman. So Ged made the charm well and honestly, working on it all that night and the next day, omitting nothing, sure and patient, though all the while his mind was strained with fear, and his thoughts went on dark paths, seeking to imagine how the shadow would appear to him next, and how soon, and where. And when the spell was made whole and cast, he was very weary. He slept that night in the fisherman's hut in a whale-gut hammock, and got up at dawn, smelling like a dried herring, and went down to the cove under Cutnorth Cliff, where his new boat lay. He pushed it into the quiet water by the landing, and water began to well softly into it at once. Stepping into the boat light as a cat, Ged set straight the warp boards and rotten pegs, working both with tools and incantations, as he had used to do with Petchvary and Low Torning. The people of the village gathered in silence, not too close, to watch his quick hands and listen to his soft voice. This job, too, he did well and patiently until it was done, and the boat was sealed and sound. Then he set up his staff that Ogion had made him for a mast, stayed it with spells, and fixed across it a yard of sound wood. Downward from this yard, he wove on the wind's loom a sail of spells, a square sail, white as the snows on Gaunt Peak above. At this the women watching sighed with envy. And then, standing by the mast, Ged raised up the mage wind lightly, and the boat moved out upon the water, turning towards the armed cliffs across the great bay. When the silent watching fishermen saw that leaky rowboat slip out under sail as quick and neat as a sandpiper taking wing, then they raised a cheer, grinning and stamping in the cold wind on the beach. And Ged, looking back a moment, saw them there cheering him on under the dark, jagged bulk of Cutnorth Cliff, above which the snowy fields of the mountain rose up into cloud. He sailed across the bay and out between the armed cliffs onto the Gauntish Sea, there setting his course northwestwards to pass north of Aranea, returning as he had come. He had no plan or strategy in this but the retracing of his course, following his falcon flight across the days and winds from Oskill. The shadow might wander or might come straight. There was no telling. But unless it had withdrawn again wholly into the dream realm, it should not miss Ged coming openly over open sea to meet it. On the sea he wished to meet it, if meet it he must. He wasn't sure why this was, yet he had a terror of meeting the thing again on dry land. Out of the sea there rise storms and monsters, but no evil powers. Evil is of earth, and there is no sea, no running of river or spring in the dark land where once Ged had gone. Death is the dry place. Though the sea itself was a danger to him in the hard weather of the season, that danger and change and instability seemed to him a defense and a chance. And when he met the shadow in this final end of his folly, he thought, maybe, at least, he could grip the thing, even as it gripped him, and drag it with the weight of his body and the weight of his own death down into the darkness of the deep sea, from which, so held, it might not rise again. So at least his death would put an end to the evil he had loosed by living. He sailed a rough, chopping sea above which clouds drooped and drifted in vast, mournful veils. He raised no mage wind now, but used the world's wind, which blew keen from the northwest. And so long as he maintained the substance of his spell-woven sail, often with a whispered word, the sail itself set and turned itself to catch the wind. Had he not used that magic, he would have been hard put to keep the crank little boat on such a course. On that rough sea, on he went, and kept keen lookout on all sides. The fisherman's wife had given him 2 loaves of bread and a jar of water, and after some hours, when he was first in sight of Camaber Rock, the only isle between Gaunt and Aranea, he ate and drank and thought gratefully of the silent Gauntish woman who had given him the food. On past the dim glimpse of land he sailed, tacking more westerly now in a faint, dank drizzle that over land might be a light snow. There was no sound at all but the small creaking of the boat and light slap of waves on her bow. No boat or bird went by, nothing moved but the ever-moving water and the drifting clouds, the clouds that he remembered dimly as flowing all about him as he, a falcon, flew east on this same course he now followed to the west. And he had looked down on the gray sea then, as now he looked up at the gray air. Nothing was ahead when he looked around. He stood up, chilled, weary of this gazing and peering into empty murk. "Come, then. Come on, what do you wait for, shadow?" There was no answer, no darker motion among the dark mists and waves. Yet he knew more and more surely now that the thing was not far off, seeking blindly down his cold trail. And all at once he shouted out aloud, "I am here! I get the Sparrowhawk, and I summon my shadow!" The boat creaked, the waves lisped, the wind hissed a little on the white sail. The moments went by. Still Ged waited, one hand on the yew-wood mast of his boat, staring into the icy drizzle that slowly drove in ragged lines across the sea from the north. The moments went by. Then, far off in the rain, over the water, he saw the shadow coming. It had done with the body of the Oscillian oarsman Skjörg, and not as Gebeth did it follow him through the winds and over sea, nor did it wear that beast shape in which he had seen it on Roque Knoll and in his dreams. Yet it had a shape now, even in the daylight. In its pursuit of Ged and in its struggle with him on the moors, it had drawn power from him, sucking it into itself, and it may be that his summoning of it, allowed in the light of day, had given to it or forced upon it some form and semblance. Certainly it had now some likeness to a man, though being shadow it cast no shadow. And so it came over the sea, out of the jaws of Enlad towards Gaunt, a dim, ill-made thing pacing uneasy on the waves, peering down the wind as it came, and the cold rain blew through it. Because it was half-blinded by the day, and because he had called it, Ged saw it before it saw him. He knew it as it knew him among all beings, all shadows. In the terrible solitude of the winter sea, Ged stood and saw the thing he feared. The wind seemed to blow it farther from the boat, and the waves ran under it, bewildering his eye, and ever and again it seemed closer to him, seemed closer to him, seemed closer. He could not tell if it moved or not. It had seen him now, though there was nothing in his mind but horror and fear of its touch, the cold black pain that drained his life away. Yet he waited unmoving. Then all at once, speaking aloud, he called the mage wind strong and sudden into his white sail, and his boat leaped across the gray waves straight at the lowering thing that hung upon the wind. In utter silence the shadow, wavering, turned and fled. Upwind it went, northward. Upwind Ged's boat followed, shadow speed against magecraft, the rainy gale against them both. And the young man yelled to his boat, to the sail, and the wind, and the waves ahead, as a hunter yells to his hounds when the wolf runs in plain sight before them. And he brought into that spell-woven sail a wind that would have split any sail of cloth, and that drove his boat over the sea like a scud of blown foam, closer always to the thing that fled. Now the shadow turned, making a half circle and appearing all at once more loose and dim, less like a man, more like mere smoke blowing on the wind. It doubled back and ran downwind with the gale as if it made for Gaunt. With hand and spell, Ged turned his boat, and it leaped like a dolphin from the water, rolling in that quick turn. Faster than before he followed, but the shadow grew ever fainter to his eyes. Rain, mixed with sleet and snow, came stinging across his back and his left cheek, and he could not see more than 100 yards ahead. Before long, as the storm grew heavier, the shadow was lost to sight. Yet Ged was sure of its track, as if he followed a beast's track over snow instead of a wraith fleeing over water. Though the wind blew his way now, he held the singing mage wind in the sail, and flake foam shot from the boat's blunt prow, and she slapped the water as she went. For a long time, Hunted and Hunter held their weird fleet course, and the day was darkening fast. Ged knew that at the great pace he had gone these past hours, he must be south of Gaunt, heading past it towards Spevy or Torhaven, or even past these islands out into the open reach. He could not tell. He did not care. He hunted, he followed, and fear ran before him. All at once, he saw the shadow for a moment, not far from him. The world's wind had been sinking, and the driving sleet of the storm had given way to a chill, ragged, thickening mist. Through this mist, he glimpsed the shadow, fleeing somewhat to the right of his course. He spoke to wind and sail, and turned the tiller and pursued, though again it was a blind pursuit. The fog thickened fast, boiling and tattering where it met with the spell wind, closing down all around the boat, a featureless pallor that deadened light and sight. Even as Ged spoke the first word of a clearing charm, he saw the shadow again, still to the right of his course, but very near, and going slowly. The fog blew through the faceless vagueness of its head, yet it was shaped like a man, only deformed and changing like a man's shadow. Ged veered the boat once more, thinking he had run his enemy to ground, and in that instant it vanished. And it was his boat that ran aground, smashing up on shoal rocks that the blowing mist had hidden from his sight. He was pitched nearly out, but grabbed hold on the mast staff before the next breaker struck. This was a great wave, which threw the little boat up out of water and brought her down on a rock, as a man might lift up and crush a snail's shell. Stout and wizardly was the staff Ogion had shaped. It did not break, and buoyant as a dry log, it rode the water. Still grasping it, Ged was pulled back as the breaker streamed back from the shoal, so that he was in deep water and saved till the next wave from battering on the rocks. Salt-blinded and choked, he tried to keep his head up and to fight the enormous pull of the sea. There was sand beach a little aside of the rocks, and he glimpsed this a couple of times as he tried to swim free of the rising of the next breaker. With all his strength, and with the staff's power aiding him, he struggled to make for that beach. He got no nearer. The surge and recoil of the swells tossed him back and forth like a rag, and the cold of the deep sea drew warmth fast from his body, weakening him till he could not move his arms. He had lost sight of rocks and beach alike, and did not know what way he faced. There was only a tumult of water around him, under him, over him, blinding him, strangling him, drowning him. A wave swelling in under the ragged fog took him and rolled him over and over and flung him up like a stick of driftwood on the sand. And there he lay. He still clutched the yew-wood staff with both hands. Lesser waves dragged at him, trying to tug him back down the sand in their outgoing rush, and the mist parted and closed above him, and later a sleety rain beat on him. And after a long time he moved. He got up on hands and knees and began slowly crawling up the beach away from the water's edge. It was black night now, but he whispered to the staff, and a little warelight clung about it. And with this to guide him, he struggled forward, little by little, up toward the dunes. He was so beaten and broken and cold that this crawling through the wet sand and the whistling sea thundering dark was the hardest thing he had ever had to do. And once or twice it seemed to him that the great noise of the sea and the wind all died away, and the wet sand turned to dust under his hands, and he felt the unmoving gaze of strange stars on his back. But he did not lift his head, and he crawled on, and after a while he heard his own
gasping breath, and felt the bitter wind beat the rain against his face. And the moving brought a little warmth back into him at last, and after he had crept up into the dunes where the gusts of rainy wind came less hard, he managed to get up on his feet. He spoke a stronger light out of the staff, for the world was utterly black. And then, leaning on the staff, he went on, stumbling and halting half a mile or so inland. And then on the rise of a dune he heard the sea louder again, not behind him, but in front. And the dunes sloped down again to another shore. This was no island he was on, but a mere reef, a bit of sand in the midst of the ocean. He was too worn out to despair, but he gave a kind of sob and stood there, bewildered, leaning on his staff for a long time. And then, doggedly, he turned to the left, so the wind would be at his back at least, and shuffled down the high dune, seeking some hollow among the ice-rimed, bowing seagrass where he could have a little shelter. As he held up the staff to see what lay before him, he caught a dull gleam at the farthest edge of the circle of wear-light, a wall of rain-wet wood. It was a hut, or shed, small and rickety, as if a child had built it. Ged knocked on the low door with his staff. It remained shut. Ged pushed it open and entered, stooping nearly double to do so. He could not stand up straight inside the hut. Coals lay red in the fire pit, and by their dim glow, Ged saw a man with white, long hair who crouched in terror against the far wall, and another, man or woman, he could not tell, peering from a heap of rags or hides on the floor. I won't hurt you, Ged whispered. They said nothing. He looked from one to the other. Their eyes were blank with terror. When he laid down his staff, the one under the pile of rags hid, whimpering. Ged took off his cloak that was heavy with water and ice, stripped naked and huddled over the fire pit. Give me something to wrap myself in, he said. He was hoarse and could hardly speak for the chattering of his teeth and the long shudders that shook him, and if they heard him, neither of the old ones answered. He reached out and took a rag from the bed heap, a goat hide, might have been years ago, but it was now all tatters and black grease. The one under the bed heap moaned with fear, but Ged paid no heed. He rubbed himself dry and then whispered, "Have you wood? Wood? Build up the fire, little old man. I come to you in need. I mean you no harm." The old man didn't move, watching him in a stupor of fear. Do you understand me? Do you speak no Hardik? Ged paused and then asked, Kargad? At that word, the old man nodded all at once, one nod like a sad old puppet on strings, but as it was the only word Ged knew of the Kargish language, it was the end of their conversation. They found wood piled by one wall and built up the fire himself, and then with gestures asked for water, for swallowing seawater had sickened him, and now he was parched with thirst. Cringing, the old man pointed to a great shell that held water and pushed towards the fire another shell in which were strips of smoke-dried fish. And so, cross-legged close by the fire, Ged drank and ate a little, and as some strength and sense began to come back into him, he wondered where he was. Even with the mage wind, he could not have sailed clear to the Kargad lands. This islet must be out in the reach, east of Gaunt, but still west of Karegohat. It seemed so strange that people dwelt in so small and forlorn a place, a mere sandbar. Maybe they were castaways. But he was too weary to puzzle his head about them then. He kept turning his cloak to the heat,
The silvery Palawi fur dried fast, and as soon as the wool of the facing was at least warm, if not dry, he wrapped himself in it and stretched out by the fire pit.
"Go to sleep, poor folk," he said to his silent hosts, and lay his head down on the floor of sand and slept.
3 nights he spent on the nameless isle. For the first morning when he woke, he was sore in every muscle and feverish and sick. He lay like a log of driftwood in the hut by the fire pit all that day and night. And the next morning he woke still, stiff and sore, but recovered. And he put back on his salt-crusted clothes, for there was not enough water to wash them, and going out into the gray, windy morning, looked over this place whereto the shadow had tricked him. It was a rocky sandbar, a mile wide at its widest, and a little longer than that, fringed all about with shoals and rocks. No tree or bush grew on it, no plant but the bowing seagrass. The hut stood in a hollow of the dunes, and the old man and woman lived there alone, in the utter desolation of the empty sea. The hut was built, or piled up, rather, of driftwood planks and branches. Their water came from a little brackish well beside the hut. Their food was fish and shellfish, fresh or dried, and rockweed. The tattered hides in the hut and a little store of bone needles and fish hooks, and the sinew for fish lines and fire drill came not from goats, as Ged had thought at first, but from spotted seal. And indeed, this was the kind of place where the seal will go to raise their pups in summer. But no one else comes to such a place. The old ones feared Ged not because they thought him a spirit, and not because he was a wizard, but only because he was a man. They had forgotten that there were other people in the world. The old man's sullen dread never lessened. When he thought Ged was coming close enough to touch him, he would hobble away, peering back with a scowl around his bush of dirty white hair. At first the old woman had whimpered and hidden under her rag pile whenever Ged moved, but as he had lain dozing feverishly in the dark hut, he saw her squatting to stare at him with a strange, dull, yearning look, and after a while she had brought him water to drink. When he sat up to take the shell from her, she was scared and dropped it, spilling all the water, and then she wept and wiped her eyes with her long, whitish-gray hair. Now she watched him as he worked down on the beach, shaping driftwood and planks from his boat that had washed ashore, into a new boat, using the old man's crude stone adze and a binding spell. This was neither a repair nor a boat building, for he had not enough proper wood and must supply all his wants with pure wizardry. Yet the old woman did not watch his marvelous work so much as she watched him with that same craving look in her eyes. After a while she went off and came back presently with a gift, a handful of mussels she had gathered on the rocks. Ged ate them as she gave them to him, sea-wet and raw, and thanked her. Seeming to gain courage, she went to the hut and came back with something again in her hands, a bundle wrapped up in a rag. Timidly watching his face all the while, she unwrapped the thing and held it up for him to see. It was a little child's dress of silk brocade, stiff with seed pearls, stained with salt, yellow with years. On the small bodice the pearls were worked in a shape Ged knew, the double arrow of the god brothers of the Kargat Empire, surmounted by a king's crown. The old woman, wrinkled, dirty, clothed in an ill-sewn sack of sealskin, pointed at the little silken dress and at herself and smiled, a sweet, unmeaning smile like a baby's. From some hiding place sewn in the skirt of the dress, she took a small object, and this was held out to Ged. It was a bit of dark metal, a piece of broken jewelry, perhaps, the half-circle of a broken ring. Ged looked at it, but she gestured that he take it, and was not satisfied until he took it. Then she nodded and smiled again. She had made him a present. But the dress she wrapped up carefully in its greasy rag coverings
and she shuffled back to the hut to hide the lovely thing away. Ged put the broken ring into his tunic pocket with almost the same care, for his heart was full of pity. He guessed now that these two might be children of some royal house of the Karget Empire. A tyrant or usurper who feared to shed kingly blood had sent them to be cast away, to live or die on an uncharted islet far from Karegoat. One had been a boy of 8 or 10, maybe, and the other a stout baby princess in a dress of silk and pearls. And they had lived, and lived on alone, 40 years, 50 years, on a rock in the ocean. Prince and Princess of Desolation. But the truth of this guess he did not learn until years later. The quest of the Ring of Erath Akbi led him to the Karget lands and to the tombs of Atwan. His third night on the isle lightened to a calm, pale sunrise. It was the day of sun return, the shortest day of the year. His little boat of wood and magic, scraps and spells, was ready. He had tried to tell the old ones that he would take them to any land, Gaunt, or Spivey, or the Torricles. He would have left them even on some lonely shore of Karegoat, had they asked it of him, though Kargish waters were no safe place for an archipelagan to venture. But they would not leave their barren isle. The old woman seemed not to understand what he meant with his gestures and quiet words. The old man did understand, and refused. All his memory of other lands and other men was a child's nightmare of blood and giants and screaming. Ged could see that in his face, as he shook his head and shook his head. So Ged that morning filled up a sealskin pouch with water at the well, and since he could not thank the old ones for their fire and food and had no present for the old woman as he would have liked, he did what he could, and set a charm on that salty, unreliable spring. The water rose up through the sand as sweet and clear as any mountain spring in the heights of Gaunt, nor did it ever fail. Because of it, that place of dunes and rocks is charted now and bears a name. Sailors call it Springwater Isle. But the hut is gone, and the storms of many winters have left no sign of the two who lived out their lives there and died alone. They kept hidden in the hut, as if they feared to watch, when Ged ran his boat out from the sandy south end of the isle. He let the world's wind, steady from the north, fill his sail of spellcloth, and went speedily forth over the sea. Now, this sea quest of Ged's was a strange matter, for as he well knew, he was a hunter who knew neither what the thing was that he hunted, nor where in all Earthsea it might be. He must hunt it by guess, by hunch, by luck, even as it had hunted him. Each was blind to the other's being, Ged as baffled by impalpable shadows as the shadow was baffled by daylight and by solid things. One certainty only Ged had, that he was indeed the hunter now, and not the hunted. For the shadow, having tricked him onto the rocks, might have had him at its mercy all the while he lay half-dead on the shore and blundered in darkness in the stormy dunes, but it had not waited for that chance. It had tricked him and fled away at once, not daring now to face him. In this he saw that Ogion had been right. The shadow could not draw on his power so long as he was turned against it. So he must keep against it, keep after it, though its track was cold across these wide seas, and he had nothing at all to guide him but the luck of the world's wind blowing southward, and a dim guess or notion in his mind that south or east was the right way to follow. Before nightfall, he saw, way off on his left hand, the long, faint shoreline of a great land, which must be Karegoat. He was in the very sea roads of those white, barbaric folk. He kept a sharp watch out for any Kargish longship or galley, and he remembered, as he sailed through red evening, that morning of his boyhood in Ten Alders village, the plumed warriors, the fire, the mist. And thinking of that day, he saw, all at once,
with a qualm at his heart, how the shadow had tricked him with his own trick, bringing that mist about him on the sea, as if bringing it out of his own past, blinding him to danger and fooling him to his death. He kept his course to the southeast, and the land sank out of sight as night came over the eastern edge of the world. The hollows of the waves all were full of darkness, while the crests shone yet with a clear, ruddy reflection of the west. Ged sang aloud the winter carol, and such cantos of the deed of the young king as he remembered, for those songs are sung at the festival of sun return. His voice was clear, but it fell to nothing in the vast silence of the sea. Darkness came quickly, and the winter stars. All that longest night of the year he waked, watching the stars rise upon his left hand and wheel overhead and sink into far black waters on the right, while always the long wind of winter bore him southward over an unseen sea. He could sleep for only a moment, now and then, with a sharp awakening. This boat he sailed was in truth no boat, but no thing more than half charm and sorcery, and the rest of it mere planks and driftwood, which, if he let slack the shaping spells and the binding spell upon them, would soon enough lapse and scatter and go drifting off as a little flotsam on the waves. The sail, too, woven of magic in the air, would not long stay against the wind if he slept, but would turn to a puff of wind itself. Ged's spells were cogent and potent, but when the matter on which such spells works is small, the power that keeps them working must be renewed from moment to moment, so he slept not that night. He would have gone easier and swifter as falcon or dolphin, but Ogion had advised him not to change his shape, and he knew the value of Ogion's advice. So he sailed southward under the west-going stars, and the long night passed slowly until the first day of the new year brightened all the sea. Soon after the sun rose, he saw land ahead, but he was making little way towards it. The world's wind had dropped with daybreak. He raised a light mage wind into his sail to drive him towards that land. At the sight of it, fear had come into him again, the sinking dread that urged him to turn away, to run away. And he followed that fear as a hunter follows the signs, the broad, blunt, clawed tracks of the bear that may at any moment turn on him from the thickets. For he was close now. He knew it. It was a queer-looking land that loomed up over the sea as he drew nearer and nearer. What had from afar seemed to be one sheer mountain wall was split into several long, steep ridges, separate isles, perhaps, between which the sea ran in narrow sounds or channels. Ged had pored over many charts and maps in the tower of the Master Namer on Roke, but those had been mostly of the archipelago and the inner seas. And he was out of the East Reach now, and did not know what this island might be, nor had he much thought for that. It was fear that lay ahead of him, that lurked hiding from him or waiting for him among the slopes and forests of the island, and straight for it he steered. And now the dark forest-crowned cliffs gloomed and towered high over his boat, and spray from the waves that broke against the rocky headlands blew, spattering against his sail as the mage wind bore him between two great capes into a sound, a sea lane that ran on before him deep into the island, no wider than the length of two galleys. The sea, confined, was restless and fretted at the steep shores. There were no beaches, for the cliffs dropped straight down into the water that lay darkened by the cold reflection of their heights. It was windless and very silent. The shadow had tricked him out onto the moors in Oskill, and tricked him in the mist onto the rocks, and now would there be a third trick? Had he driven the thing here, or had it drawn him here into a trap? He didn't know. He knew only the torment of dread and the certainty that he must go ahead and do what he had set out to do, hunt down the evil, follow his terror to its source. Very cautiously he steered, watching before him and behind him and up and down the cliffs on either hand. He had left the sunlight of the new day behind him on the open sea. All was dark here. The opening between the headlands seemed a remote, bright gateway when he glanced back.
The cliffs loomed higher and ever higher overhead as he approached the mountain route from which they sprang, and the lane of water grew narrower. He peered ahead into the dark cleft and left and right, up the great cavern-pocked boulder-tumbled slopes where trees crouched with their roots half in air. Nothing moved. Now he was coming to the end of the inlet, a high, blank, wrinkled mass of rock against which, narrowed to the width of a little creek, the last sea waves lapped feebly. Fallen boulders and rotten trunks and the roots of gnarled trees left only a tight way to steer. A trap. A dark trap under the roots of the silent mountain, and he was in the trap. Nothing moved before him or above him. All was deathly still. He could go no further. He turned the boat around, working her carefully round with spell and with makeshift oar, lest she knock up against the underwater rocks or be entangled in the outreaching roots and branches, till she faced outward again, and he was about to raise up a wind to take him back as he had come, when suddenly